Welcome to the VIP Jaswal Report, the report that asks insightful questions and gets revealing answers. Let me ask you this. In order to be successful, do you need to cheat? And as a society, are we too forgiving, or have we just lowered our own standards of ethics and morals? Let's find out, because our guest today is Dr. Bruce Weinstein, affectionately known as the Ethics Guy. Bruce gives talks on the subjects of ethics to schools, the military and corporations. He's the author of Ethical Intelligence and has also written a book for teenagers called Is It Still Cheating If I Don't Get Caught? Welcome to the show, Bruce.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Main question, what's the difference between ethics and morals?
You know, it's like saying, what's the difference between caliente and hot? They're two different words that describe the same thing. And historically, the word from which we get morality was the Latin translation of the Greek word from which we get ethics. So broadly speaking, they both refer to right and wrong conduct and good and bad character.
Well, Tiger Woods, Anthony Weiner, Elliot Spitzer, General Petraeus, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lance Armstrong, the list goes on. And more have shown to compromise ethics in their pursuit of success. Are ethics and morals relevant qualities in our society anymore?
They're more relevant than ever, and I'll tell you why. The people that you just mentioned benefited in the short run from their self-centered, selfish behavior. But in the long run, every person that you mentioned ended up worse off. Tiger Woods ended up being humiliated around the world through his series of affairs. General Petraeus lost his major position. Arnold Schwarzenegger ended up writing a book that tanked, and his latest film also did not do well. So it's fascinating when you take a step back and you look at the long arc of a person's career, someone who has consistently made the wrong choices, they end up worse off than they started. And that's why ethics and morality are more relevant than ever.
But, you know, it seems to be it's the price to pay to get to the top.
No, well, it seems that way.
And at least they got to the top.
Well, if you think about your own career, and if I look at my career, and I'll bet every single person listening to this program can pinpoint a couple of times where perhaps we made the wrong decision. But in the long run, we've achieved what we have through ethical conduct. But you don't tend to hear these stories. The stories we hear in the media focus almost always on the people who have taken the low road. But this is not the full picture. It is not at all the full picture of how people actually behave in the real world.
But, you know, it seems to me that today it actually pays to cheat, because here's a secret formula. You cheat, you get caught, you take a leave of absence, you write a book. You then get back into the profession, and then to top it off, you become a celebrity. You're laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, but look at what happened to Lance Armstrong. I mean, he's on his what some people call his apology tour, which always starts, of course, with an Oprah interview. But he's lost his Tour de France titles. He's lost the respect and the trust that people placed in him. And for the rest of his life, this is how he's going to be remembered. And in fact, he's not close to dying, but whenever he does pass away, I'll bet in the first paragraph of his obituary, the scandal is mentioned. The first paragraph.
But you know, sorry to interrupt you, but with Lance, time is yet to pass its course, because you look at Tiger Woods, he's still playing. You look at Elliot Spitzer, he's got his own TV show. You look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, at least he got someone to sponsor a book. He got someone to sign him onto a movie deal. Okay, the movie tanked, the book tanked, but he still got a payout. Mm-hmm.
You know, the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote the classic The Great Gatsby, once said, there are no second acts in American lives. But we believe in the power of redemption, and if you mess up, even mess up to a really great degree, as the people you just mentioned, why shouldn't, in the long run, people be able to right their wrongs, get back on track, and help other people learn from their mistakes? That would be the best outcome. I mean, if Lance Armstrong really were sorry for what he did, he would devote a significant portion of the rest of his career or life to talking with kids around the world and explaining why he made the choices he did. Just like prisoners or former convicts will go to schools and say, these are the choices I made, this is how I ended up, ask me some questions, but it's in your own interest not to follow my path.
Okay, well, let's take this one step further. Do you think, as a society, we are too forgiving, or have we just lowered our ethical and moral standards? And the reason I'm asking that is because any civilized society should allow redemption, but I do not sense the same feeling of grief or sorrow on the wrongdoer's part.
You know, we as consumers, as the public, do bear a great degree of responsibility for, let's say, television shows and movies that consistently show people engaging in the worst form of conduct because, let's face it, this is a capitalist society, and Hollywood and producers of mass media would not be putting out this product if it didn't sell. So we can't, on the one hand, throw up our hands and say, oh, the Real Housewives of New Jersey or whatever the show is, the Jersey Shore, this is disgusting, this is reprehensible, if, on the other hand, we're tuning into this and supporting it. You can't have it both ways. And I don't know about you, but I started to watch The Real Housewives of New Jersey a few years ago because I'd heard so much about it. And I felt dirty afterwards. I'm not a prude, but I felt like I needed a really hot shower to get rid of the filth that I'd been exposed to. And I didn't find that entertaining at all. So I voted by not watching it anymore. And that's the best way to vote in a capitalist society, through our wallets, our pocketbooks, our remote controls.
Well, you know, do you think as a society we like to finger point? Because we often blame Hollywood and the media for glorifying violence, drugs, sexuality, possibly more. And here's my thought on this. No one forces us to watch anything, because the greatest weapon of democracy on earth is actually the remote control. We seem to have this subconscious appetite for bad news, and this demand is met by supply. That's the business of capitalism. It's quite simple.
It reminds me of what Pogo used to say, we have met the enemy and he is us. And it is, I mean, let's face it, there are plenty of folks out there who are doing things that they shouldn't do and who don't display noble behavior. But as you suggest, if we're supporting this by buying magazines that show people at their worst, or paying to see films that revel in the most gratuitous kinds of violence, there's a place for that kind of entertainment, but if that's all that we have, I mean, to what extent are we to blame for this? I have to tell you that I loved the film Django Unchained, and I think it's Tarantino's most mature work to date, and it's his first film that exhibits moral revulsion at violence, in particular slavery. So there is certainly a place in our culture for violent fare, but what I wonder is, why isn't there anything else out there? You open the paper, you try to find a film or a TV show to watch, and it's almost impossible to find a story about good people doing good things.
Well, that's right.
Bad people.
That's right, because when did you last see a faithful husband become a celebrity?
They're out there. You're faithful, I'm faithful. A lot of let's say all of your listeners are faithful, but where are the stories about us? So if bad news sells and good news does not, if stories about people doing harmful and hurtful things, evil things to one another sells, and the opposite kind of entertainment does not, we are partly to blame. I heard an attorney say the other day, if you're part of the market, you're responsible to some degree for that market. And that really says it all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why are we not making winners of the guys who came in second in the races that Lance Armstrong took part in?
The people who didn't cheat, you mean?
Yes.
Right. Well, it's going to be a long time before the sport, I think, regains its trust, because as Armstrong told Oprah, and I believe him in this count, this is a systemic problem. It wasn't just a few people. This was supported throughout the sport. So the whole culture has to change. But the culture can change. I mean, as this film Django Unchained shows, in this country, slavery was perfectly acceptable for a lot of people. But that's changed. I mean, in fact, another film, Lincoln, shows exactly what it took to change the laws, to make them right. And it took a lot of political maneuvering and actually some trade-offs that you might say, well, that, you know, it's sort of reprehensible what people had to do to pass the legislation. But the bottom line is it got passed, and we no longer believe in this country that slavery is morally acceptable.
What did you think of the Lance Armstrong interview?
I was disturbed by it because it seemed so self-pitying. And for one thing, if someone admits that he or she has cheated for most of his career, you do tend to lose a lot of credibility, and you don't know. It's like the boy who cried wolf. You don't know to the degree to which they're telling the truth now, if they've lied so much in the past. But what concerned me is that he dwelled so much on his own culpability, which is good. I mean, I've always felt that it's never too late to right a wrong. There's always time to admit that you've done something you shouldn't have. But I didn't hear any talk about what he will do to turn this into something positive for young people who have looked up to him and admired him as a leader. And as I suggested a minute ago, if he devoted part of his time or a big chunk of his time to traveling around the country and the world, talking with young people and letting them ask questions, he could use this stain on his career and this horrible incident and become a force for good. It is never too late, I believe, to be a force for good.
Well, you know, it's all part of that same formula I told you earlier on. He cheated. He got caught. He's taking a leave of absence. I bet you he's going to write a book. And then he's going to get back into the profession, or if not, at least become a celebrity, some way, shape, or the other.
Well, let's take a look.
And he'll still be laughing all the way to the bank.
Let's look at the book example. I'm not sure that publishers are going to touch him because they realize that that book may not sell very well. And it is a capitalist undertaking. So if publishers don't think it's going to sell, they're not going to publish it. But in terms of him getting or getting back on track, people are so fed up with having been lied to for so long by this guy. I'm not sure that they would support a second career. And, you know, before when I said F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American life, and that I challenged that, there are second and third acts, it doesn't mean that you can get back on the same track that you were on. In Lance's case, it would make a lot of sense to get on a completely different track and use what he did wrong to teach people how to be better than he was. And that would be a happy ending to the story. It really would. Because he'd be preventing other people from following his example. And that actually would be good leadership in a weird way.
Well, ethics are taught in major professions like medicine and law. But do you think we should be starting these at an earlier age, possibly as a separate subject, in order to build a strong foundation for the youth?
You know, it's an interesting question that I'm asked all the time across the country, should ethics be taught? And my response is always, ethics is always taught. Every time a teacher walks into the classroom, that teacher is teaching ethics by his or her example. How you punish a student, how you talk with a student, if you play favorites, all of that is implicitly giving moral instruction to the kids. But the reason I wrote my teen book is because, yes, there is a place for formal, structured discussion about ethical problems that kids face, and they do. I mean, at one point in a student's life, he or she is going to see someone else doing something wrong. They may never cheat themselves, but at some point, whether it's in school, whether it's in their careers later, they're going to see somebody doing something they shouldn't be doing, and the question is, what's the right way to respond to that?
But, you know, I mean, in today's world, yes, the teacher walks in. That sort of teaching is an implied form of education. Should there be something a little more direct, like the subject itself?
Yes, there should be. And the reason people are skittish about teaching ethics is because of the false belief that there are different ethical standards in different parts of the country, different parts of the world, different religions have different ethical principles. They can all actually be boiled down to five basic principles that I use to teach ethics. I'm here in Minnesota, away from my desk in New York, teaching ethics to a group of business folks, and it's the same five principles I'll be using when I go to speak to kids next week in California. The same five principles. So we can honor the diversity in the classroom that the kids bring to the table by teaching ethics at a very basic level of basic ethical principles.
What would you do if you were empowered with increasing our moral and ethical values in society?
this is obviously a self-serving answer, but by using a textbook like the one I've written, it doesn't have to be mine, of course, but using a book that lays out an ethical framework and presents case studies, you know, real-life situations that kids find themselves in, like seeing someone else cheating or a friend who posts something inappropriate on Facebook, and to talk about that in class openly and honestly, and to discuss and to debate these issues.
But that could be considered academic. If you had to implement certain values into, say, daily practice, what would you consider doing?
Well, the most basic value that I think is most flagrantly disregarded in our culture is a value that we associate with doctors and nurses and pharmacists, but that really applies to all of us, the principle, do no harm. If all we did in school is teach that principle and show how it applies in daily life and how not taking it seriously harms everyone, including you, that would go a long way by teaching just that principle.
Now, in your book, Ethical Intelligence, and Is It Still Cheating If I Don't Get Caught, you talk about five basic ethical principles. Could you tell me what they are?
Well, the first one, as I just said, is do no harm, the most fundamental principle of all. It's not just for physicians, it's for everyone. The second is make things better. It's not enough to avoid hurting people. Ethics demands more of us and calls upon us to use our skills, our knowledge, what we do best in life, to make things better for other people as well as ourselves. The third principle is the principle of respect, which covers issues like telling the truth, keeping private things private, and keeping our promises. Principle number four tells us that we ought to be fair, that we ought to treat one another with a sense of fairness or justice. And the fifth one is the one that's easily in the shortest supply in the world, but when you're on the receiving end of it, it's the one you probably appreciate the most, and that's the principle of compassion or kindness or care.
Where does lying come into all of this?
Well, lying has to do, when someone lies to you, you feel betrayed because fundamentally someone has disrespected you. So that's not to say that we ought to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth all the time, because, you know, if someone says to you, Vip, does this dress make me look fat? And you say, not only does it make you look fat, it makes you look gargantuan.
I have been known to say that.
Well, and how do people respond when you say that? They want to be your friend after
No,
that?
They don't.
So there's a good example of how one can be truthful to a fault. If you were to say something like, you know what, I've seen you in outfits that are more flattering to you. That would be truthful, but also not hurtful. And also, let's face it, when someone asks you, do you like the tie I'm wearing? Do you like, does this dress make me look fat? Most people don't really want the truth. They want to be validated for the choice they've already made. So telling them the truth, the raw, unvarnished truth, is not only hurtful, it's not giving them what they're asking for.
So I'm adding 2 points to your 5 point list, and that is diplomacy and emotional intelligence.
Yes. Emotional intelligence, now this is really, I'm glad you mentioned that, because emotional intelligence is a concept that a fellow named Daniel Goleman made popular about 16 or 17 years ago. And he wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence, and it's taught all over the world. And it's really important because it helps us be attuned to how other people are feeling, even though they might not be revealing how they feel and what they say. But it's not enough to have emotional intelligence. It's not enough to know that somebody is not feeling well, even though they tell you, I'm fine. We also need ethical intelligence, which tells us how to respond to people when we sense they're not doing well. So we need, in other words, to be fully human, we need both emotional intelligence, which is about psychology, and ethical intelligence, which is about ethics or morality.
So is soft lies or white lies, as we call it, acceptable?
You know, the tricky thing about telling lies, even small lies, is that once you get into the habit of it, it's easy for those little lies to become bigger and bigger. And again, this is not to say that we always owe everybody the full truth, but it's a dangerous policy to adopt to say, well, some lies are okay.
So here's an eighth point, then, a discipline. You have to discipline yourself.
That's right. And without discipline, these principles are worthless. And also without courage. That's a missing piece of this puzzle, because if you don't have the courage to apply these principles, if you don't have the courage to stand up to someone who's doing something evil or wrong, then the principles are worthless. You know, they shouldn't stay on the page of a book. These principles are meant to be lived every day. And the thing is, it's extraordinarily difficult to apply these principles. If it were easy, more people would be doing it. But every day we're challenged, and in every interaction we have with someone, we're challenged with respect to these principles. And it's very easy to take the low road. It's easier to lie than to tell the truth. It's easier to gossip than to keep private things private. So the challenge is to recognize that in the long run, these principles are actually good for our friends and our colleagues, but also we benefit professionally and personally when we apply them, recognizing that it's really, really hard to do that.
Well, you've written these books. You give lectures. Do you consider yourself more ethical than other people?
I have to say that probably the reason I became a professional ethicist is because it helps me keep on track. I absolutely do not consider myself more ethical than anyone, and I've done plenty of things in my life and continue to do things that I'm not proud of, but I keep being drawn to these principles and drawn to the things that we talk about in these ethics workshops, and try to, you know, walk the talk, so to speak, and to live by the things, I guess you could say, to practice what I preach. So even though I call myself the ethics guy, there's no way I would ever advertise myself as the guy who's more ethical than everybody else, because it just wouldn't be true.
So how can our listeners get in touch with you?
I have a website, theethicsguy.com, where people can take an ethics quiz and find out how ethical they are for free. My books you can get from your local independent bookseller, Let's Support the Independents, or your favorite online bookseller. And if you want to book me to speak to your group, you can do so right on my website, theethicsguy.com.
Thank you for coming on the show, Bruce.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is it for today. Thank you for listening. Feel free to send in your comments to our Facebook page at facebook.com/Fox News Radio or tweet us at Fox News Radio on Twitter. I'm your host, Vip Jaswal, and keep your ears open for the next airing of the Vip Jaswal Report, coming soon.